Some months, you're flooded with jobs and make multiple placements. Other months, a big fat zero. This feast and famine cycle isn't just stressful, it's holding you back and keeping you from real predictable growth. Here's the good news. There's a reason it's happening, and you can fix it. The 7-Figure Freedom Scorecard is a free tool designed for recruitment business owners. In less than 10 minutes, it evaluates your firm across the 6 key pillars of sustainable growth: clients, candidates, team, operations, marketing, and strategy. Your personalized scorecard will reveal what's working and what's broken, and the fastest way to build a recruitment business that generates consistent 7-figure revenue month after month. Stop riding the revenue roller coaster and take the free scorecard now at recruitmentcoach.com/scorecard. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. I'm joined today by Nathan Callahan. Nathan is a managing director at Future Heads Recruitment. Future Heads are an award-winning digital recruitment company based in London with a team of 30. They've been awarded Great Place to Work multiple times, as well as listed on the London Stock Exchange's 1,000 Companies to Inspire Britain several years in a row. Nathan has close to 30 years recruiting experience with substantial leadership experience running recruitment businesses within the digital and technology space. He's worked in startups as well as management teams within high growth recruitment environments. He's worked in-house. He's been a business owner. And he joined Future Heads in 2013, where he found a leadership position that allowed him to balance a values-led approach with commercial thinking. Nathan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks very much for the invite, Mark. It's really good to be here.
Awesome. So, listen, I would love to talk about, you know, what's been happening at Future Heads for the last year or so during a very challenging period, as well as what you guys have planned for the future. I think you guys have handled the whole pandemic situation, you know, better than most, although I'm sure there's still, you know, learnings and mistakes that, you know, in hindsight, things you might have done differently. But part of the reason we got in touch with you is you were recognized by Recruiter Magazine in their Hot 100 list, which is the most successful recruitment companies in the UK based on GP per employee. And that was during the COVID-19 crisis. So you must be doing a lot of things right. Before we dive into that, though, There's a couple of topics I'd love to touch on based on having looked through your website. One is the idea of niche specialization. Mm-hmm. This is something I'm a huge believer in, and some people get it, some people don't. But I understand you guys, each of your consultants specialize in a specific digital discipline. Could you just touch on why you do that and why you believe in being a niche expert?
Yes, I think for us, the digital community respects people that are prepared to invest time in understanding what they truly do. So what we look to do is balance the rigor of good recruitment practice alongside genuine interest in the space. So I think it's such a competitive market. Clients and candidates can smell a pitch a mile off. And if they feel that someone is feigning interest in their discipline just to secure an opportunity, it doesn't land particularly well. So the way in which we're set up is saying that actually spend the time working with that community, understand what makes it tick, contribute to the debate around that community as well, and share your learning and your experiences. That creates a conversation with your target market about what's important to them, and the conversation about recruitment naturally extends from that. So rather than kind of, you know, looking to communicate in a way that says, right, we're here to hire for you, give us a mandate to go and hire. So actually, tell us about what you do, tell us how it works, tell us why. Right, okay, we can now use that understanding to go and secure the best talent for you in the way that's important. So it's just flipping the conversation slightly. The other piece though is as you scale, it's really important to be able to put a good, strong account management or client management wrapper around that niche focus. Because ultimately, you know, we look to work with, you know, on a repeat business basis with a number of customers. We want to increase the amount of engagement we have with each client. That would inevitably mean working across more than one discipline. So it's just really important to manage that transition effectively from being, right, I'm your go-to person for UX, to actually being, right, I'm your go-to person for UX, product design, engineering, product management, whatever it might be. So that transition piece is one of the more challenging aspects for us from, you know, in terms of managing the client journey.
Interesting. I wasn't expecting this to come up, but could you say a little more on how you handle that? Because I suppose if you're dealing with larger repeat accounts, and you each have a niche discipline, you know, that you're experts in, then how do you manage that from a client perspective so they're not talking to 30 different people in the business?
Yeah, well, engage your customer in a conversation. Say that how you know, what works for you. How do you want us to do this? I think it's amazing how many times you'll sit on briefing calls or you sit in meetings of competition and they are so busy imposing their structure or the way in which they want to engage with the client rather than saying, well, hold on a minute, what works for you and your team. So have the conversation. Understand what's important. And then it comes down to it's really about the positive working relationships internally within Future Heads, getting people together to understand, you know, what's actually the key objective for that customer. What is it we're actually trying to deliver? Does everyone understand the role they need to play internally to enable that overall objective to be delivered? Because ultimately, if the customer's super engaged and happy, that means more opportunity for everyone. It means we all benefit from it. So I think if you can bring a truly collaborative approach to that customer conversation and you share with the client what you want to achieve and wrapping what's important to them, those two things can come together and deliver a really strong customer experience. Yeah, you've got to be prepared to really engage with the customer and understand what's important with them. You've got to be prepared to ask those questions and secure feedback. You also then need to be prepared to hear that feedback and act on it. You might hear things that you don't really want to hear, but you're not the most important person in the room. You're there to facilitate the right introductions between a client and the individual there, or a company, and the individual they want to hire. So it needs people to be robust. And to hear things that they don't want to hear, and that can be challenging for some individuals. So, supporting our team in, you know, going through that process is a big part of what we do.
Wow, that's really interesting. A couple of things from that. One is, do you have a sort of account management structure that allows you to gather that feedback and be proactive in planning with the customer in terms of their, you know, hiring needs, so that you're able to deliver a pipeline of talent? Or what's the mechanism for exchanging this feedback? And
it's something we're always trying to do better. You know, never going to say we're perfect at all. There's clearly some client relationships where it works really well, and others where it's definitely a work in progress.
Nathan, what's the difference then? Like the customers where it does work really well versus the customers where it's a work in progress. What would you say is the main difference between those two?
I think it's the it's about empowering the individuals engaged with that customer in early stage. So there definitely can be a tendency as leaders or as managers in this situation to kind of sort of wade in and say, right, okay, guess what? I've got the plan for the client. I know what we're going to do. We're going to get this, you know, and take a more directive role in that, in that process. And that works for a period of time. But actually, where we've really seen it sort of take off, and where we've really seen high levels of engagement with customers is where actually there is a bit of teaching from the leadership or the management for the wider group. There is so that the skills base is increased, and then we go into very much a coaching model with the account team, giving them the chance to put the teaching in into practice, and then supporting them and empowering them. Basically, it's the it's giving people the freedom to make some mistakes along the way, and accepting that actually it might be a little bit bumpy at times. Always terrifying when it's a really important customer, and you feel like it's all got to be perfect first time. But if you don't give your team that freedom and that space to operate, the relationship it doesn't really grow. It only ever stays tied into that one senior figure, and that isn't ultimately good for the client or for us.
Interesting. That's really awesome because. Exactly. How do you grow a business if it's the leaders and the senior managers who are taking charge of all the key decisions and contact points with the customer? It's balancing the development and giving people the opportunity to develop with you need to be commercial at the same time. How do you find that balance? Because I think the fear that a lot of now to be fair, you guys are growing and many recruitment businesses never get past like 10 employees. And I think this is one of the reasons is that the managing director wants to control everything and is very directive and wants to be, own the customer relationship and wants to close all the offers and so on, because they're worried about losing money. And that really proves to be a bottleneck. But at the same time, you don't want to make massive mistakes that cost you a relationship. So how do you find that equilibrium?
It's for me about putting the right level of structure in place so people understand what the standards the level of standard that is expected of them as they go through a particular process. Making sure that there's appropriate level of training and support as they work through that process, so they have the chance to learn and they feel comfortable when they go into applying that for the first time. But it is really tricky because things have to be done in a certain way in order to deliver a consistent client experience or consistent candidate experience. But you also do have to allow people the freedom to show more of what they're about. You've got to that personal element is such an important piece from a sort of relationship development perspective. Sort of candidates and clients want to engage with someone they like and that's someone they can connect with, and if you stifle that, it can be very tricky. So it's a fine line to walk, but for me it is that mixture of right, okay, there's a minimum set of expectations and standards across the business, but with enough room for people to sprinkle a bit of their secret, their secret dust on that and say, right, actually, this is what makes me special. This is why people connect with me as an individual and why they will continue to come back to me.
Awesome. Yeah, no, that makes sense. There's a famous story. I don't know if this is even true, but there's like a sort of myth around IBM and Tom Watson. When Tom Watson Sr. was the CEO of IBM, there was a young executive who made a decision which ended up costing them $10 million. And of course he was, felt terrible, and he went to tender his resignation, and Tom Watson said, what the heck are you doing? And he said, well, I've just made this terrible mistake. It was a wrong decision and it ended up being very costly. So, I think I should resign. And Tom Watson said, I've just spent $10 million on your training and education. Why, I don't want to, why would I let you go at that point? That I've already made a huge investment in you. So I think whether that story is true or not, I don't know, but I liked the moral behind it anyway.
No, it's fair enough. It's definitely something that sits with me a lot on the back of last year is the, getting that balance of giving people freedom and the opportunity to try things, accepting that there's going to be some toe-curling moments and they'll make mistakes, and the urge to kind of dive in is always going to be there.
Absolutely.
But also applying that to applying that to myself and to the leaders in the business as well, because it's, you know, over the past, or during COVID, there's been no real frame of reference for how to deal with this. You know, it's been yes, you can look back over previous recessions, for example, and say, right, okay, I'm going to apply my sort of recession methodology to get this done. But it was such a unique sort of circumstances, and I do think we have to be a little bit kind to ourselves as well, having been through that process, and accept that actually, you know, there were some mistakes made, and there were some things that perhaps would have done differently. But hindsight is a wonderful thing. It isn't. And at the time, you know, you've got to accept you're doing the best you can in a pretty unique situation.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's talk about that then. What do you feel were like some of the key lessons learned from 2020, and how has that shaped your approach to 2021?
Yeah, sure. I think, picking up on that point about sort of frame of reference, I think the first thing we did was I went into recession mode. So that, you know, like in previous scenarios, it's like, okay, what's the most important thing we need to do? Or, you know, client acquisition is the key thing. It suddenly flipped to being such a candidate-rich market in a matter of weeks. You know, we lost about two-thirds of our job flow within a matter of days. So it was a pretty challenging environment from a client acquisition perspective. So we absolutely piled in. So everyone has to be 360. Everyone has to be out there winning new customers. Put a lot of pressure and expectation on more of our experienced people to do that. But it was in reality, even a lot of our experienced people, they'd only really worked in a boom market. So, and our brand is strong. Client acquisition has never really been an issue for us for a number of years. So I think there was perhaps some learning around actually were we asking people to do what the business needed rather than actually asking them to be the best version of themselves. It felt a necessary thing to do, but it put a lot of stress on people who were already having to deal with a lot of stress externally. You know, it wasn't even though we were behaving like it was a recession, it wasn't a typical recession. There were just so many other factors that were putting people into a difficult space. So I think certainly when I look at what we're doing now, we've absolutely learned that lesson of the 360, if you call it sort of recruitment job, is a varied, complex beast that requires lots of different skill sets. And it's for me, it doesn't feel reasonable to expect everyone to be able to do that all of the time. Don't get me wrong, there are some people out there who can do it and enjoy that. But you've got to be great at client acquisition. You've got to be great at talent pooling. You've got to be great at process management. You've got to be a good marketeer. You've got all these different elements to it. So I think we looked back on what we were asking people to do during that time, and as we were coming into recovery mode, and then sort of out of that into really sort of higher performance and sort of thrive mode, it was about saying, actually, let's stop pushing people to do something that doesn't feel comfortable. Let's stop pushing to do something where the enjoyment and the engagement isn't there, and let's create career paths that allow people to still progress to the kind of leadership position they want in the business, but do it in a component of the recruitment job that really makes sense to them. So whether that's client acquisition, whether that's process management, candidate engagement, whatever it is. And I think that as we plan now, that giving people that control back, I think has been a big part of what's worked for us as we come into 2021. I guess the other thing for me as well is I think from a resilience point of view, I definitely learned a lot about what it means to really engage with people during such a difficult time. So know, the kind of the go-to place in when times are tough, you know, sort of thump your chest and you try and do a big Churchillian speech and you kind of come out and, you know, you kind of, you want to be this bombastic leader who's going to kind of, you know, guide people to the to a happier place. That wasn't what everyone needed really last year. It was people, my take on it is people, they needed to hear that they need to be heard. They need to be able to say that they weren't okay. They needed to stop being told that actually everything's just going to be okay if they just do this. It was much more about, right, okay, let's just accept that things are pretty tricky. It's okay for that. It's not a bad thing. And rather than seeing that acknowledgement that things were tough as a sign of weakness or as a lack of motivation on the path from the individual, and therefore trying to fix it, it's more just about saying to people, you can say that without any fear or concern. And I think as a fixer, you know, it's a flaw of mine, as a fixer type, you know, see a problem, want to get in and fix it. And last year was the ultimate scenario for a fixer. It's like, oh, there's all this stuff going on, I'm gonna rush around and do everything. It was I think there are, you know, there are some people who just needed a bit of space, actually. And I think, and again, that's really informed how we approach people, I think, now within the business. It's one-to-ones and engagement with people. It's you know, that there has to be that time to just talk about them and where their headspace is at. There has to be the opportunity for them to really talk openly and honestly about how they feel, get it out, and then be able to move on to talk about work and then be, you know, and the actions and the tasks. So there's a bit of that's really asking ourselves as a management team and me as lead the business to say, like, am I really balancing, you know, what's right for the individual alongside what's right for the business? And always, as someone who's probably more of a commercial MD type, you know, that's where my head goes to. It's been a development area for me to say, actually, don't just chase that number, chase the well-being piece, because that will ultimately create the right environment for people to then go and perform.
So many things in there that you just shared, and I appreciate you being so open and transparent about that. What do you think you got right and wrong in terms of communicating with staff during the pandemic, and how has the business adapted in order to incorporate some of those learnings ongoing, like from now on?
Yeah, so I think we did work really hard to communicate from the off. So when we realized how challenging it was going to be, we put in place regular communication channel with the wider business about the financial health of the business, what we were basing decisions on, what would be triggers for us to make effectively negative decisions around people. So whether that would be a reduction in headcounts or furlough, whatever it might be. And we communicated those in a very, you know, in an open and transparent way, and we made ourselves accessible to the business. It was quite difficult because people wanted reassurances that we weren't able to give at that time. You know, we were very clear, but what we did do is we set out what were the conditions for changes to be or decisions to be made. When unfortunately those, you know, things got tough to the point where, you know, we could see the job flow was so challenging, there wasn't a market opportunity. We basically made a decision to make the changes we had to make in one go. So did everything we needed to do, and then from that point immediately went into, right, how do we build back from here? So kind of, you know, trying to break the cycle of, right, there's this thing hanging over us and there's this sort of cycle of sort of pressure and fear, if you like, but actually saying, right, we know what we're dealing with, here's the deal, here's the plan, you know what's going to happen, we are going to work really hard to build that back and get everyone, you know, back from furlough as soon as we can, get the level of activity in the business back to the point where it can support everyone. hire some people, you know, get us back on that path to recovery. I think that level of openness was appreciated. I think people respected it. It was agreed that the founders would come back in and support in that process. So there was a unified approach to the business, and it was about using different voices to deliver the same messages, so we connected with everyone, because this was such a personal thing for so many people. It's really important that those people that responded to me better heard from me. Those that responded better to one of the founders heard from her. I think it was about leaving egos at the door and saying, right, this is about us working as a collective management team to get the business back to the place where we know it deserves to be. So we're going to do that together. It isn't about one of us being the savior or one of us kind of riding into it. So again, I think that worked. The other thing we did, which really worked, I think, was we could have thrown the values out of the door. So we could have said, right, collaboration doesn't work. It's all everyone out for themselves. Money's the most important thing. Just go and get every piece of business you can. You know, well, don't worry about long tail. Long tail sales cycle. Don't worry about customer retention. It's just what you can get from that placement right now. Go and do that. And we resisted all of that. We held to the values. We didn't. We made some tough decisions, but we didn't compromise on who we and who we are. I think that's left us in a better position as a result. I think we can honestly say that in the worst scenario to face recruitment sector for a generation, actually we could have compromised and we didn't. And I feel pretty good about that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's huge. That's huge, Nathan. You might remember back in episode 43, I talked to Plamen Ivanov, the executive chairman of iIntro. If you missed it, it's well worth going back into the archives and having a listen. One of the things we talked about was a way for recruiters to shift the conversation with prospects away from fees and make it all about value. iIntro has created a tool called the Bad Hire Calculator that you can show to your prospects that proves to them that your recruitment service will save them potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars. When you can do that, the exact fees you charge almost become immaterial because you've proved that you will save the client the most money in the long run. If you'd like to add this tool to your arsenal, you'd be pleased to know that I've partnered with iIntro and they're offering a 25% discount to listeners of the Resilient Recruiter podcast. All you have to do to claim this discount is book a free consultation and mention my name or this podcast. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained, follow the instructions, and iIntro will take care of the rest. That's recruitmentcoach.com/retained. Could you just briefly touch on the values? What are the values that you held to throughout this challenging period?
Yeah, sure. So I think, as I said, the ethics is the first one. So just not compromising on those, not sacrificing how we engaged with candidates and clients in order to chase a commercial return, still doing the right thing by everyone in the process, even if that meant at times we were beaten to a commercial opportunity by someone who was willing to cut corners. The inclusivity piece is really important. It's really important to us, giving everyone the chance to be empowered and have the opportunity to do what to do their bit to make the business a success. Collaboration was so important. It was really, I said, putting the egos to one side and saying, right, we are better if we don't compete amongst ourselves. We're better if we work together. We're better if we lean on each other. That was a big piece. And then there's the transparency element. As I said before, don't shy away. Yeah, we could have presented an image that we could have hidden all the company finances. We could have hidden the data. We could have told a story that made everyone feel better. But And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, we're having to make changes or make some difficult decisions. We didn't do that. We stuck to our guns and said, people respect and appreciate transparency. That's what we're about. We're going to do it. And I think that's it made for quite an intense environment. You could argue that some people perhaps didn't want to hear everything, didn't need to hear everything, but it felt on balance the right thing to do.
I agree 100%. And, you know, I'm a huge believer. And, you know, Nathan, I've interviewed leaders of some of the fastest growing recruitment businesses in the UK, as well as like really world-class top billing recruiters. And one of the common, I would say not 100%, but by and large, the feeling I get from people is thinking long term, in the way that you operate within your market, the way you deal with clients, candidates, and team members, is you always have that long term view that might cost you in the short term, but means that you are building a sustainable business and career and reputation and relationships in the long run. So, I mean, I think you absolutely did the right thing there.
As I say, it's just interesting that point. We took that long term approach with our customers and with our candidates. I think one thing where we have to acknowledge we're perhaps caught out a bit was just understanding the intensity of that work and time was doing to the people that were still in the business and experiencing it. Mm. So I think everyone has had such an intense personal experience during COVID. I don't think it's a case of one person's had it easy, one person's had it hard. I think everyone's had their own personal stuff to deal with, which has been so challenging. So whether you were working through it, whether you were on furlough, whether you lost your job, I'm talking people, not about personal stuff, people from a professional point of view. Everyone had their own things to deal with. But I thought it was interesting when I look back, we took the long tail approach with our clients. But I think I admitted to understand the what we need to do in terms of a long tail approach for our people working through that process, because it was so intense. And it's interesting as we go through we are working through recovery, so, things are improving, everything, we're in a good place and we're growing. You can still see the legacy of that time on some people who work through it. They're still pretty jaded and still pretty tired, and it's hard for them to feel like they've had some kind of respite from that. It was incredibly tough. It's now suddenly incredibly busy, and they've had to experience those massive swings in opportunity. it has been tough for them.
I think intense is the perfect word to describe what it was like for everybody in different ways. And, you know, it was quite traumatic in many ways, and certainly stressful. No matter what was happening in your personal life or business life, I mean, the overall stress level that everybody was under was increased for sure. So what impact did that have in terms of your well-being and your team members? And then what, you said maybe you didn't recognize at first the impact that it was having in terms of the team members' well-being. What are you guys now doing in order to acknowledge that and work with that?
I think it's sometimes you can get addicted to that intensity. I think there is and certainly having that. One thing I'd say about last year is there was such a clarity of purpose about what we were doing. So it was kind of this was the market conditions we're faced with. Here's what we're doing. We're absolutely going to do that. We're going to crack on. And for me personally, that clarity of purpose works really well. It's great. But it can be quite draining. It can be quite intense. And clearly, not everyone's you know, not everyone was in that. So from my perspective on me, I think there was definitely an element of keeping an eye on myself and not letting myself become so such sort of tunnel vision on that purpose and that recovery piece, that kind of, you know, I didn't lose sight of what needed to happen with people along the way. I think the impact it's had on others since is certainly there's been a desire for change. So you know, we've had some attrition where people you know, no issue with the business, just need to do something different because all they've been doing is that one thing for that period of time, and they just need they need a change and they need a refresh, and that's completely understandable. And that's also, you know, as we're hiring, we're seeing that as one of the motivators for people joining us. It's like, actually quite happy with my business previously, but I need something different. I need a change of scenery. I think in terms of the wellbeing piece, we looked to engage with people around, okay, how are they feeling, what's important to them, how do they need to work, how can we maintain some sort of personal connection between you all, given there's you're so you know, such a distributed group. You know, heavy sort of social environment, lots of personal interaction day to day in the office. Overnight, all of a sudden, you're only talking, you know, you're only talking on screens like this. It's been really challenging. We brought in some additional external resource to help from a wellbeing perspective. So we increased the remit of our HR resource to be able to provide more pastoral care. One of the founders is fantastic at providing ad hoc pastoral care as well. So lent on her to do that. And then we engaged a business called Sanctus, who provide wellbeing support and coaching for the team. So what people can do is they can book themselves in anonymously to have a 40-minute session with a mental health coach who will help them work through however they're feeling or whatever they're experiencing at the time.
I love that. There, that's amazing.
Yeah, the emphasis there was, I'm not going to say, a huge shout out to the Sanctus team. I think they're brilliant. And it's been incredibly useful in giving people an opportunity to, even if they think they feel great, it's just giving them an opportunity to take some time and just say, right, actually, where is my headspace really at? What do I need to do? Do I need to get myself out of something? Do I need to approach the situation in a slightly different way? And just talking to someone completely anonymously outside of the business, where there's no fear of it being sort of considered about a future date or referenced or thought. I just think it's an incredibly useful thing. Personally, I've benefited from it. I thought it was great. There's a bit of, going back to the points I made earlier on, that there's a bit of personal development and learning for me and the management team around how we engage with people, but also leaning on external resource as appropriate to fill in the gaps where we frankly don't have the skills and the experience to do it.
Nathan, can I ask on a practical note, given that it's anonymous, how do you know the take-up and the effectiveness of the service? Like, how do you evaluate the impact it's having for people?
So some people are willing to give feedback about whether they did it. We don't push for it, but some people share what they have done. We're able to understand the level of take up on the sessions, so whether they're booked or not. I think it's one of those things. You've got to really buy into it as a buy into the spirit of it as much as anything else. So you can't put something in anonymously and then say, right, but I really want to understand everything that's coming out of it. You've got to be willing to look at it as part of a holistic approach to well-being and how you're engaging with your team. The feedback that we've had is that it's a good service and people value it, and the take-up's where we want it to be. It feels like a good thing to do, to be fair. And I think sometimes you just do things because it's a good thing to do, really. You know,
I accept that for sure. Okay, awesome. And so looking forward now, I mean, the market is surging back. The pendulum has swung very rapidly and to the other extreme, right, of being very candidate-driven. And so there's a massive opportunity. How are you guys trying to capture that opportunity, but bearing in mind that people are still really suffering from the stress and the burnout levels from what we've just been through? What's the kind of approach there?
Yeah, so we think about this a lot. I think first off, we had to acknowledge that partly because of the way that people are working and also a bunch of external pressures, in the personal as a result of being the pandemic, there's definitely been a bit of a disconnect between the sort of the vision for the business and the team. And you can't put that all down to just working remotely. You know, you can't just say because people aren't in the office, there's a disconnect, because that's too simplistic, I think. What we did look to do was a shift the narrative and being right, let's stop reacting to what's going on around us, and actually we will set our own course, we will set our own vision and our way of working, regardless of what the market throws at us. And if we, it's an element of sort of taking back control, so giving people the sense of ownership and feeling that they are part of something and that their contribution means something, and it will help them progress either, you know, financially or career development, whatever it might be. So there was a big piece about reconnecting with the vision, and that vision is to be everyone's favorite. So, you know, whether we are everyone's favorite employer or favorite supplier or partner, whatever it might be. So making that real to people. I think the breaking down those the components of that 360 role and offering them as different career paths with very clear routes to leadership and management. For me, leadership isn't just about line management; it's about how, you know, functional leadership, commercial, whatever it might be. But putting our money where our mouth is, really, and saying that actually, if you are incredible at developing existing relationships within customers, then you can progress to a board position through that track. If you are purely about client acquisition, you can do that. I think that's really worked for us.
I would love to learn more about this, because you mentioned it earlier, and I've made a note here to ask you about the career paths available at Future Heads, because what typically happens is so some businesses have a 360 model and some have a 180 or a 120 model where the role is broken down. So you've got salespeople, you've got recruiters, candidate delivery people. However, the real opportunity is on the client side, because those are the folks arguably who are, now it takes both. You need the candidates to make placements as well.
Yeah.
But arguably the business development and sales, the commercial side is where the money is and the progression. So it's more likely that you're going to progress if you come through the sales route and then you become like a team leader, a manager, or what have you. And there's a less clear path for recruiters. Either they transition to 360 or into a BD role, or they kind of stay where they are. And I'm not sure how to address that.
I think that to me feels a bit of an outdated view of this kind of, you know, all the glory is in the client acquisition and the BD role. And actually, if you're handling talent pooling or, you know, sort of creating shortlists and managing the candidate experience, somehow you're seen as some sort of lesser recruiter, and you're not adding value. I just think that's an outdated view. We don't view externally a client relationship any different to a candidate relationship. We're an introductionist business. We're there to bring two different sets of, you know, ideally two matching sets of expectations together. And that facilitation process is what we're about. If you come at that saying, right, I'm only bothered about what the client thinks, or I'm only bothered about what the candidate thinks, then you can't truly match those expectations. You don't truly facilitate. You're basically favoring one over the other, and that doesn't work. So So if we have that mindset externally, why do we then throw that away internally and say, actually, you only have a future if you're good at business development. You only have a future if you can manage your client. It can't be the way to do it. So each part of the process has value. It has equal value. You can't favor one over the other. So my personal view is it's about getting people, working with people to help them understand the value that they give to the process, and getting them to understand that actually it is all an equal, everyone has an equal part to play. And actually, if you are fantastic at engaging with the candidate community and you're brilliant at finding top talent, that's what clients want, right? You can't do that without having someone originate some clients to work with. But just originating clients without having top talent to give them doesn't get you anywhere either. So I think, Nathan, as a sector, we need to balance a bit, really.
Yeah, listen, I buy into that. I agree philosophically. But what does that look like on a practical basis in terms of like the structure of the business the career path or the promotion options for people? How does it work at Future Heads?
No, that's fair enough. Basically, we have a set structure where you work from a sort of consultant to a senior and then a lead, so everyone has the same set of titles. So there's no. So you're not a delivery person. You're not a BD. Yeah. Everyone has the same title, but there are separate sets of responsibilities depending on what your focus is. So if you're focused on candidate generation and engagement with existing customers and managing that process, your set of responsibilities would be all geared towards that, and you're measured against the effectiveness of those responsibilities. You then have a sort of 360 role, and you have client acquisition, and we also have our embedded effectively our on-site and embedded consultancy model as well. Future Heads on, and that provides a career path for people who want to engage on a one-to-one basis with brands, but also want to retain some of the variety of customer engagement that you would get as an open market consultant. So rather going purely in-house and staying just with one organization and only being able to work with a different set of stakeholders by moving jobs, you can sit in that area, deliver a project for 6 to 9 months, gain experience with that customer, move on to the next one. So everyone has the same title, everyone has the same career path through, but you are measured purely on your outputs against the set of responsibilities for the job you do. And what we look to do is partner up and link people working on different parts of the process together, so as they progress, they have a natural peer group to be able to go to help fill in the gaps for them. So you'd have perhaps a lead consultant working on, say, candidate generation and process management for existing clients. They would partner with a lead client acquisition figure, so they naturally benefit from working together, sharing experiences, understanding the strengths of each other, which then helps them do their job.
And okay, so this is really interesting because I've not seen quite this model before, Nathan. So do those partnerships persist, with two people who like working together, or are they dynamic? So you partner with different people at different stages or?
Different people at different stages. So we put this structure in place really within the last 3 months. It's grown at the moment. The relationships between people have grown organically. So you can see people naturally sort of partnering and working with others. As we bring additional headcount in, as we scale, the challenge for us is going to be, right, how do we actually go about partnering with those people? How do we partner those people up? How do we understand how people work and the kind of individual they would bounce off and who they'd benefit from working with? But that comes back to that point about collaboration earlier on. If you set your stall out, that collaboration is the starting point for everything you do. Yes. Should, in theory, give you two people coming or group of people coming together the right headspace. But it's certainly it's going to be interesting to see as we scale whether we can whether we can maintain the integrity of what we're doing.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So, how do you identify which area of focus each individual is? It self-selecting, like someone knows already, look, I really want to focus on the, you know, the client acquisition piece, or I'm more geared, you know, I'm more about candidate experience, or like how do they even know if they're new to recruiting where they will naturally fit?
So we offered existing staff the chance to self-select.
Yep.
So absolutely. So here is the opportunity. Here are the different jobs you can do. What would you like to do? And then as we are hiring now and we're bringing new people in, the conversation during the interview process is which career path would you like to go? And it is fluid, right? So for example, there's an individual who's joined us recently that absolutely have aspirations and a desire to do a 360 position, but relatively early in their career, and actually wants to really really hone the candidate generation and process management piece before doing that. So it absolutely is no issue at all. They've come in as a consultant. It could be that as they progress, they switch tracks and they end up being a lead 360 because they've been able to swap over at a later point. I think people have to feel like they have a level of control and ownership over their over their career. They need to feel like it's theirs. Otherwise, we get back to the place where we're just directing them and telling them what to do, and you end up with quite a jaded workforce, and one that isn't particularly self-sufficient.
This is really interesting, Nathan, and I think the one pro of the 360 model is that each individual is naturally balancing the supply and the demand dynamically on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. And so if you need more clients, you go and get them. Or if you're pretty overloaded and you just need to focus on resourcing, you can do that. Whereas if you have split roles within the business, how do you manage the dynamics of that where, you know, you need more jobs or you need more candidates and it's a little bit less quick to respond to those changes in the dynamic?
Yeah, I think there are always people in the business. From personal experience here, over the last 8-9 years, there have always been people in the business who naturally lean towards client acquisition or client development. They enjoy it. They like it. It's their thing. So I personally feel like if 90% of your staff were purely focused on candidate generation and servicing existing relationships, there's going to become a point where you're going to run out of work. You're going to run out of work for those people. So there's absolutely a balance to strike there. We've tended not to struggle with identifying people who and retaining people who can go out and win opportunity, because we take a long term approach as well to business development. With every relationship to us, the aspirations that every relationship is important. Every contact needs to be a good one. It doesn't matter who you're talking to, so candidate or client. Do they walk away feeling like, right, that's a good business? I would refer them. I would recommend them. And we're very protective of the brand. And actually, what we find is that because we are so active in terms of how we contribute to the debate, and because we do care about the level of experience we're giving, The brand acts as a business development tool, and it's saying, right, we are regularly approached by businesses who want us to work. Who want us to work with them. So, awesome. So I think I think the slightly sort of one note approach to business development is, right, okay, there's a phone, there's your target list, crack on and make some calls, and nothing wrong with that at all. It's like, it's part of it. But I think you have to look at business development and client acquisition in a slightly more rounded fashion, and accept there are many different ways. There are many different ways to do it. Totally. Goes back to the earlier point. If you contribute to the debate in the right way, if you care about your discipline, people will seek you out to work with you. They will come to you and say, come and engage with us. So
Do you know, I wish, in fact, if we had more time, I would love to learn more about how you guys are engaging with each of your sort of specialist, you know, disciplines within digital. And that could be an interesting one, maybe for our next conversation, Nathan.
Sure.
So I love your vision of being everyone's favorite recruiter, whether you're a client, a candidate, employee, a supplier, what have you. What's the vision in terms of, you know, growth from here?
So I think we actually have aspirations to grow. We are looking at growth, not just within our contingency recruitment teams, but within our on-site and embedded consulting and consulting offering, and that would be certainly both in the UK and further afield.
Cool.
The aspiration to grow is not based on achieving a certain number of headcount by fixed time. So we're not going to say, right, by next year it needs to be 60 people. That's it. Because the aspiration is to grow with the right people, is to get the right talent. And that and giving that talent space and opportunity to be, you know, the best it can be. So I don't think that works to a fixed schedule as much as I'd love it to. I think you have to. You can have an aspiration to grow without putting an arbitrary number on it. So I think I'd love to have a conversation within 12, 18 months time and say, right, okay, we were 30, we're now 40, close to 50. Be amazing, but I would rather have a team, the right size team of amazing people, rather than hire people who just to put a bum on the seat, because that's not fair on the individual joining the business, and it's not fair on everyone else that works here.
Do you know, I agree 100%. I have seen fast growing recruitment businesses where they've got to hit a headcount number, you know, in that quarter, and sometimes the quality of new hires does get diluted for the sake of making those targets rather than making sure we have the right people who are going to prosper and contribute and really who will be able to retain in the long term. So,
and yeah. everyone's hiring right now. I mean, it's quite, yes. Unsurprisingly, everyone's after the same people. So we're taking a slightly different approach to it, where we'd always talk to people who already recruit within digital and recruit in other sectors, but we've looked at really what makes a future head and what we think is the right sort of core attributes for recruitment and the way in which we want to engage with our communities, and we're taking people from different sectors and giving them the opportunity to flourish. So. We're talking to people from all walks of life, where most importantly the attitude and you know the aspiration is there. So I think it's an interesting time. It's going to, I believe, create an environment where there's genuine culture add and the kind of diversity of thought we're looking for at all levels.
Amazing. I can't, since you mentioned it, I can't not ask you, what do you see as being the attributes that you're looking for that, you know, are more important than specific experience?
Yeah, it's that thing, isn't it? I think first off, it's a genuinely caring about what you do. So not just a customer service ethic, but one where you have a sense of pride and in what you're doing and a belief in doing the right thing for yourself, for your colleagues, and for your the people that you work with. Recruitment is a challenging job. We know that. it can be amazing for you when it goes well. It can be a challenging job when it doesn't. So I think the ability to maintain a level head during the best and worst of times. I think there's a bit of kind of being humble in success, I think is probably the way I'd put it. But also not beating yourself up when things don't go too well. There's a balance. Mm. There's a balance to find there.
Yes.
And ultimately, a strong work ethic. I think if you're, you know, I Personally, I didn't leave school with an aspiration to be in recruitment. Like many others, fell into it earlier, at a young age. But it's created choices for me, and it's given me a life that I arguably wouldn't have had without it. And for that, I've got a huge amount of time and respect for it. And I think what's enabled me to benefit from recruitment is first and foremost a work ethic, which says if I work hard, if I try hard, ultimately I'll get there. And I think that's if you come into this job with that in that headspace as your starting point, it will work well for you.
Work ethic is an interesting one, because do you see there's a generational difference in the way people think about work and what they want to put into it, what they want to get out of it? Is work ethic still relevant as one of the primary criteria for hiring?
So the danger with work ethic, you can go to a negative place with it. So as a self-confessed, at times grumpy old man, I think it could be easy to sit there and say, right, okay, certain generations don't have the right work ethic, or they're not prepared to put the required shift in. And so I don't believe in that at all. I think it's, when I say work ethic, it's about, for the time you're doing the job, applying yourself in a positive and constructive way to get the best out of it. What I don't mean by work ethic is presenteeism, unnecessary long hours, taking work home with you, not being able to leave it behind when you walk out of the office or walk away from your desk. That's not work ethic. It's about the output that you deliver during the time you work. That's the important thing. It's too easy. It's a bit of a lazy thing to say, younger generation this, different generation. No, it's not. People are people, no matter what generation they're from. It's just, everyone's. If people generally want to achieve something, they will achieve it. It's whether the want is real and they're prepared to do it.
Right. Well said. Well said. It's wanting to achieve something and being prepared to do it. Listen, Nathan, there's lots more we could talk about, but we're out of time for today. So thank you so much. It's been really interesting and a pleasure to meet you.
Same. I really appreciate the opportunity to have a chat. It's been great.